Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Dr. Carrie Gress. I said first hour, she's our friend. I hope she does. I hope she feels the same way. But we have a great friend of this program. We certainly consider her that. And she's got a new book out called, she does. Okay. She jumped in to reassure me. Her new book is Something Wicked: Why Feminism Can't Be Fused with Christianity, and that will be our topic this hour. So if you have questions about feminism and Christianity, maybe you disagree with that premise. Maybe you'd like to hear more about that premise. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. She's an author. She's a philosopher. She's a mom. Dr. Carrie Gress, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, congratulations on the new book.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's really came together, and just even the cover. I mean, it was one of those books that I was like, this almost feels like it was a little too easy, and too like all the pieces came together. It was really beautiful.
That's a good sign. I imagine that's a good sign. Well, I'm going to ask you straight out then. I'm going to start with the basic question I think that this book confronts us with. And frankly, a good bit of what you have written leads us to the question, is feminism compatible with Christianity?
No, unfortunately, it is not. It's not.
I didn't know I was going to get a one-word answer. Okay. Elaborate, please.
It's really that simple. Well, I mean, I think, first of all, obviously, you have to sort through the questions like definitions. What do you mean by feminism? And what I mean by feminism is I'm talking about the movement that's, you know, roughly 250 years old, and just a pattern that's been established sufficiently that you can actually recognize components of it in the 1800s, and then sort of the swirling in the 1860s, and then in the 1920s and 1860s, like there are some crucial pieces that are similar and keep rolling over, you know, throughout different time periods. So that's really what I mean by it. Now, if you just mean feminism is promoting women or it's just helping women, then obviously we know, you know, Catholicism in particular has been the greatest advocate and booster of women in all of human history. So if that's only what you mean by feminism, then of course they are compatible. But I think that's the problem, is that we haven't done a great job of really explaining what we mean by feminism and the ways in which feminism influences us, but also the way it's sort of hidden in the culture. And this has been one of the things that I've done too, is just even looking at why is it that we have all these issues with trying to define what it means? And I think in a lot of respects, feminism has done an amazing job of marketing itself and also protecting itself from scrutiny. So for example, you know, this is obviously a difficult topic to talk about. For men, you know, men are told you can't really have an opinion about it because you're a man. I'm told I'm not supposed to have an opinion on it because I may have benefited from feminism because I have a PhD. So I think there's a lot of just pieces that have to be waded through. And so, you know, I appreciate being on your show tonight and just kind of talking through some of them, because I think when people really start looking at the bones that are underneath it, it becomes very clear very quickly that this did not start from Christian roots.
Well, first of all, I want to say I think it's extremely controversial and should not be controversial at all. What you said about the Catholic Church, the person of Jesus Christ as a man, is the greatest thing that ever happened to a relation between men and women and all of us. And the Catholic Church has promoted the interests of women more than any other institution in the history of the world. And that's a historical fact. But man, there's so many people there, the top of their head just blows off if you assert something like that. Mm-hmm. There's this sense that really, I don't know how much we know of, you know, what I mean by we, the average person, how much the average person knows about the progress of feminism. Mm-hmm. But I think most of us would say, well, it probably started with the suffragettes, right? And so are you saying that the suffragettes were bad? Was it a bad movement to vote, to get women the vote?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great place to start, because that's exactly where I started when I was looking at this. In 2018, I wrote the book, The Anti-Mary Exposed, and that I only went back to the beginning of the second wave of feminism in that book. And I actually even say in that book that I think the roots of the first wave were good, because I didn't know. I was just really relying on scholars and different people that have been asserting this for so long, and I just had no idea. And then when I went to go write the follow-up book, which was The End of Woman, which came out in 2023. I wrote that book because there were so many people that said, can you write a book like The Anti-Mary Exposed, but one that is for Protestants or secular people that, you know, can absorb the content in a different format. So in that book, I allotted myself 2 days to do research on the first wave. I mean, that's all I allotted, because I thought, I'm just going to go back there and I'm going to find some really great quotes about Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and all these great women, and I'll just grab quotes and plug them in, you know, and show why these things are so definitive. I haven't stopped researching. I got stuck there, and I've spent so much time, and, you know, my mind was blown, because we have this sense like, oh, it was just about suffrage. It was just about the vote. It was just about, you know, education and jobs and whatnot. And then when you go back and look, you realize like, no, this starts with the roots of the French Revolution, and this idea of even that kind of underlying godless egalitarianism that was really the animator of the French Revolution. And I think Mary Wollstonecraft is you know, certainly credited as the grandmother of feminism. And while she believed in theism and God, she, by the end of her life, she had passed through Anglicanism and then became a dissenting Christian and then finally became a Unitarian. So she didn't even believe in the Trinity. She certainly didn't believe in the divinity of Christ. And she actually saw or thought that any kind of male person, whether it's a pastor, a priest, or even Christ himself, is an obstacle to a woman's spiritual potential. So she's right there with all these incredible radicals who ended up influencing Marx, and all of that. So that's really where it starts. And then, you jump across the pond back to the United States and you get into women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And, you know, this blew my mind, just the amount of, the occult and the role that spiritualism played in the lives of these women. And most of them actually became Unitarians as well. Most left either Anglican, Calvinism or the Baptist faith to Baptist form of Christianity to become Unitarians. And most were involved in some kind of occult activity. And there's one woman named Matilda Gage who had been she worked with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. The three of them wrote this long multi-volume book on the history of suffrage in the United States. And this is obviously before they had the vote. And at one point in the process of their relationship, Susan B. Anthony, who's much more proactive, said, let's just join the temperance movement. Those women are Christians, but they're much bigger, better known. So let's follow them. So anyway, she does this, and Matilda Gage hates Christians so much. She says, I'm not going to work with you anymore. And she just goes deeper into her own witchcraft. And she ends up influencing her son-in-law and her daughter in terms of seances and whatnot. And shortly after her death, her son-in-law has this vision and comes to him in this just, you know, lightning bolt. And he ends up writing the book, The Wizard of Oz, from this. He's L. Frank Baum is his name. That's the connection. So if you look at The Wizard of Oz, you can see here's, you know, good witchcraft, bad witchcraft. And then you have also this idea of the patriarch behind the curtain. That's the wizard. So the feminist themes are there, and that occult element is very much there. And almost all of the women that I researched really believed that the women's movement was akin to slavery, and that women were enslaved the way that Black Africans were in the South and in England, and that they needed to liberate them. And the way women were enslaved was through Christianity.
I wondered about. Yeah, because when you mentioned the French Revolution, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just...
No, there's
you're
so
making
much.
These... You, since my brain is exploding right now. The French Revolution is essentially, it's not just a liberation movement. It's we will replace the Catholic Church and you will be liberated movement. And so you would say feminism as it has been, as it has followed in this pattern of the French Revolution, is not just an innocent, neutral liberation movement. It is a, you need to be liberated from Christianity.
100%. Yeah. And that's very explicit. I mean, even Katie Stanton has what she calls the women's Bible that she wrote. It's very clear. She and Susan B. Anthony, their newspaper was called The Revolution. And I think it's, you know, it's hard for us to really understand all this because we think of the 1800s in sort of very Victorian, pristine terms and don't really realize how radical it was and how much that people were being influenced by socialism in particular, but just all of these radical ideas. And then you also have kind of this Wild West thing going on, you know, with electricity's just been invented or, you know, is started. People are using that in their homes. Spiritualism kind of mapped its, like, thought of itself like that. Like, this is just, we're just electricity connecting us through seances with the dead. You know, it's just all over the place, this, mm-hmm. this kind of attitude. And even New York City was just a total disaster. You had prostitution was just everywhere. And, you know, this idea of free love was really kind of in the air, the end of what we would call ending monogamy. But that the term they used was free love. So all of these pieces are hugely influential on these women. And, you know, it ends up being a very radical thing. And I think, you know, I would say, too, even in terms of the education piece, I mean, this was one of the fun things that I researched for this specific book was what's happening with education for women in the United States during the 1800s? Because this is the thing you always hear is that, you know, women aren't educated and whatnot. Well, we have, of course, Elizabeth Ann Seton, who starts the first Catholic school. And then this is early 1800s. By the end of 1800s, there are 3,500 Catholic schools in the United States. Many of those had actually been serving enslaved blacks and women and girls well before the Civil War. And almost, you know, a huge number of them were actually staffed by women religious. So it's also, you know, you begin to see like there's this difference between, you know, Protestant understanding of education and a Catholic understanding of education and these different pockets of what's happening in the church versus the Protestant world that many of these women are reacting to. So in any event, it was just, you know, it's great to start realizing that we think we know a lot about what feminism was and is about. And then when you actually go back and look, you know, it's really eye-opening to just see that, that very little maps on to reality.
Something Wicked, Why Feminism Can't Be Fused with Christianity is the new book from our guest, Dr. Carrie Gress. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. I think one of the reasons that so many people are turning to the work that you do, and in addition to all the reasons of your scholarship and your, is I do feel like we're kind of looking at the world going, what happened? And we're looking for someone to walk us through what happened? How did we get to this? So maybe we'll get into some of the transgenderism, some of the real confusion that we have, and its relation to the roots of feminism. But whatever your questions are, if you've got questions about feminism and Christianity, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884.
Your questions, Catholic Answers, live.
Support for Catholic Answers Live comes from Catholic Chemistry, a dating app for Catholics. Founded by a longtime member of the Catholic Answers team, CatholicChemistry.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
God gave us free will. And so as a result, we have to understand when we exercise that will against God, then we are going to suffer, could suffer eternal punishment.
Mother Angelica Live Classics, every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. We see the statistics all the time. Far fewer people marrying, people getting married much later, people having far fewer children than they used to. People's feelings about children more negative than they used to be. Men and women, there seems to be not just a kind of we're different kind of thing going on, but there's increasingly women see the world very different. We see more and more social science on this. Women seeing the world quite differently from men, but making different political choices, different economic choices than men. What happened? That something that got shattered here, and that is what our guest is here to help us. Am I asking the right questions, or are you going, no, he's not getting down to the deep stuff? Or am I
I'm in
the ballpark?
There. You're on pay dirt for sure. So I think these are certainly the big questions that I know I've been asking, and why, you know, I wrote these books. Certainly The End of Woman chronicles that, and I'm happy to step through like how we get from Mary Wollstonecraft to the trans movement, 50 yeah. words or fewer, hopefully.
Well, it does seem to me that at the root of your work, though, at least I have always detected this, is a sadness that women aren't happy and haven't been made happy by this. Women are hurt, and I don't know the other words for it, but unhappy. I feel like you're calling us to try to rediscover the ground of happiness here.
No, I think thank you for bringing that up, because I think that's a really critical point, is just the fact that we know that women are less happy than they were 40 years ago. And it's not because of they tell us that. It's because we can see it in the metrics, things like depression, suicide, substance abuse, all of these things point to some very unhappy women. So that's going on. But I think that's the other reality, is that nobody really chose this. I know when I was growing up, it was just sort of part of the culture, and you just absorbed it. And, you know, as a young girl, I remember being told that, you know, that you need to just beat the boys. Like that was really a motivating part of my private school education, was always competing and working towards a great career and all of that. And so, I think that there needs to be a lot of compassion in terms of understanding this, because we obviously are seeing the flip side of this, which is an incredible amount of resentment towards women. And that's, not really a good place to start building, to really help people understand what's going on. But I think there's a new openness to it as well. I've been amazed at just some of the emails I'm getting from trans males and lesbians and, you know, people you don't normally expect. I don't normally expect to hear from, really asking deep questions and coming from a place of goodwill and just saying, you know, I've never heard this. I appreciate what you're saying, even if I don't agree with 100% of it, but I appreciate that you're asking these questions and you're trying to help women, become better and be happier and figure out where we went astray. So, I think that's a really important piece to highlight for sure.
Well, Something Wicked is specifically about the relationship between Christianity and feminism. Again, Dr. Carrie Gress, our guest, and that's the new book, Something Wicked. And you have the idea in there of a shadow church. And I am going to go to calls. If you want to call now, 888-318-7884. But I don't want to do the hour and not get to this idea that I think I'm phrasing it correctly. You talk about feminism as a shadow church.
Yeah. So this was one of the fascinating things that came to mind when I was looking through all these pieces that I think define feminism. And I was trying to think of how do I put this together? Actually, I was speaking at SEEK, and I thought, how do I put this together for college students to really understand this concretely? And I started putting together all these variables, and suddenly I was like, wait a minute, this looks like a shadow church. Like, first of all, there's an idol. Obviously, we have an object of worship in Christianity, which is Jesus and the Trinity. But the idol of feminism is female autonomy. That's really the focus. So if that's really your goal, your telos, your end, what it is that you're striving for, then you're going to have very different variables that are going to kind of play out in your life in terms of your action, the way you feel about things and the way, you know, what it is that you're doing. And that's really where you then start seeing these different pieces. So there's, instead of 10 commandments, there are three commandments. And I identified these very early. These start in the early 1800s. They were articulated first in one person by the poet Percy Bysshe Shelley. He created this woman in one of his poems called Cythna. And she had contempt for men, She was promiscuous and she was involved in the occult. And, you know, it sounds obscure and, you know, maybe a little archaic or whatnot to be pointing back to the early 1800s to talk about this. But if you look at college campuses and you look at what is being promoted among women, and particularly young women today, you know, what is it that they are living out? It's this being promiscuous, contempt for men, and get engaged in the occult. So that's a very old and early pattern that came from feminism. So those are the commandments. They also happen to map on to each relationship with a member of the Trinity. So if you have contempt for men, it's going to be very hard to have a relationship with God the Father. If you are promiscuous, it's going to be very hard to have a relationship with the Holy Spirit, because our bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit. And then, of course, if you're involved in the occult, you are rejecting the authority of Christ over the earth and as God and part of the Trinity. So it's really interesting to look at those elements from that theological standpoint and really see, like, no wonder women have such a hard time embracing Christianity and understanding Christ when you deliberately, but maybe unwittingly, are cutting yourself off from the Trinity. It's pretty amazing. So anyway, there's also theological vices, and we have theological virtues. We've got faith, hope, and love. They have contempt, rage, and envy. Those are the drivers. That's what women generally are, encouraged to feel. And this also is not an accident. It was back as the 1890s. The socialists realized that if they could make women angry, that they were going to be a lot more politically active and expedient for them than if women were happy. So it's been very intentional effort to try to stir up women and get us mad. So those are the vices, theological vices. There's also the sacrament, which, of course, you and your audience have heard Peter Crave talk about abortion being the sacrament of the left, but it's absolutely the sacrament of feminism because of the fact that women are at war with their bodies and their fertility. This is, you know, the fundamental piece, because that is what threatens our autonomy. And so we have to have the capacity to abort our children in order to maintain that idol of female autonomy, and even as it relates to the workplace and whatnot, because children are a threat to that, because of the fact that if you're a mother, you know, your whole life has changed in manifold ways. So that's one of the, you know, and it comes back to that idea of that Creef said so well, you know, Christ saying, "This is my body offered up for you." Well, feminism says, "This is your body offered up for me." It inverts the whole order of creation. And, I think that's such an important point and really something that we as pro-lifers also need to be really dialed into. I think we have missed that feminism is the engine behind abortion. We've been looking way too much at the political, which obviously was important for Roe and necessary, but we need to get back to understanding, like, where is this coming from? What's fueling this? And it's 100% feminism and this idol of self, for sure.
Dr. Carrie Gress, our guest, Something Wicked, Why Feminism Can't Be Fused with Christianity, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. All right, I'll tell you what, let's go to the phones, if that's all right with you, Dr. Sure. Gress. Daniel in Española, New Mexico, watching on YouTube. Daniel, you've been very patient. Thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, thanks, Si, and thanks a lot, Carrie, for doing this show.
Sure.
So my older sister, I'm 36, she's a couple of years older than me, has forever claimed to be a feminist, and I've definitely gotten into it with her over the transgender issue and abortion, but most recently we were talking about, I think I was the one that brought it up, and I didn't realize where her head was at on this. I thought she would have been in agreement with me, but she's always said, you know, don't objectify women, don't objectify women. And I'm totally on board with that. But then at the same time, she's fully in support of legalizing prostitution. And to me, that's just, I don't get how she can hold those two views, because the ultimate culmination of objectifying women is legalized prostitution. So I'm basically at the point where I'm like, okay, am I wasting my time? Should I just totally avoid these conversations with her anymore? Or I'm kind of at a loss, and that, yeah, so.
Oh, well, I love it that you are engaging in these conversations, these tough conversations, and trying to love her well. But I think that the first thing I would say is that you know, one of the premises of feminism is this idea of promiscuity and women being able to have a sex life the way that they think bad men have sex lives. Like that's kind of a goal and a priority. And we see that among the movement. So that's why prostitution then suddenly become, you know, if you're really about being autonomous, it's not about human dignity anymore. It's really about earning and autonomy and you're, you know, somehow controlling your sexuality. It's about power and control. So those are really the pieces that are at play and why your sister is buying into these kinds of things, because it's not about love. And this is, I think, an important piece is that feminism, for all of its talk about liberation, what it has done is it has enslaved us to something new, which is degradation and use. And so this is, you know, where you can see it manifest. But as somebody who has had siblings with whom I have disagreed greatly on many things, I think there's a lot of prudence in just stepping back, not having these conversations if you're not seeing it go anywhere. And I would just really focus on being the best brother you can, loving her as best you can, and not feeling like you're going to move her intellectually, because you probably, it's going to be grace, not reason.
Daniel, you waited so long, and there's the music. I'll tell you what, you can have a follow-up. If you hang on the line, you can follow up and continue your conversation with our guest, Dr. Carrie Gress, if you like. 888-318-7884 is
Why do Catholics pray to dead people, bow to statues, venerate relics? And where do we find any of this stuff in the Bible? In the delightful book, The Saints Pray for You, Dr. Carlo Broussard convincingly defends the ancient Christian belief rooted in Scripture that the saints care for us, that they are allies. Order your copy of The Saints Pray for You today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic, and Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Cancelled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Cancelled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Dr. Carrie Gress, our guest. We're always delighted when she's here. We're always delighted when she writes a book because we know she'll come back. And we got another good one. Something Wicked, Why Feminism Can't Be Fused with Christianity. So answering a question that I think a lot of people struggle over, and a lot of people maybe make an accommodation that you're saying, don't make that accommodation. Be a little more as clever as foxes and a little less gentle as lambs here. And I do find it very helpful. I want to go back to Daniel let him continue his conversation with you. But before we end, before we go too far, I want to get what have been the responses to this, because if you're, it's like you're saying, feminism is a religion in many ways. People don't like it when you attack their religion. So I want to get that from you. But Daniel, did you have a follow-up for Dr. Carrie Gress?
I was just going to say, basically what she advised is kind of where I'm leaning towards, is just support her as much as I can. But One thing I have, it seems that a lot of people, depending on the relationship to the person they're just talking to, sometimes they have this thing where, like, okay, I can't even learn anything from this person. Mm-hmm. And me being the younger brother, I feel like that may be somewhat of an issue in there. But no,
really, Daniel, I'm shocked. My older sisters value my opinion so deeply. I'm the person that they're like, yes, little brother, we want to hear exactly what you have. You must be the only disrespected little brother out there, Daniel.
I would add to that, actually, what's really...
me.
Yeah.
Oh, Daniel. No, but what's really interesting is that, I've had men that are like, what do I do? My wife is, she's total feminist. How do I deal with this? And, one thing that you could do is just even say, like, give her the book and just say, I'd love to have a conversation or see what you think about this. And in a way that you really authentically want her opinion. And I think that's a very valid, valuable thing to do. But it starts a conversation because one of the things that I think is so challenging in the culture today, and I have a whole section on this, is that we all believe in this idea of the romantic lie. It's a very René Girard, the philosopher's idea, but the romantic lie is the belief that we think all of our choices we chose ourselves, and we don't really realize how there's sort of a platter of choices from which we can actually choose. And feminism is one of those where there's not really any other alternative to think about in the culture. So in any event, I think it, even giving her the book or something that doesn't feel like it's you, or that can be a place where you guys can actually have a conversation or a podcast or something, sort of getting yourself out of it and making it about, well, what do you think about this? I thought this was really interesting. I'd love to hear what your thoughts are, and making it actually constructive in a place where you're not going in with sort of a conceived battle plan, per se, but where you really want to have a conversation about this. And I think my book could be help facilitate that, just because there's so much in it and there's so many different pieces. And I know people are learning from it, and ideas that they've never thought about before, just because, again, nobody talks about feminism as in a negative form. And so there's a lot of material to go with. So anyway, obviously, pray about it. But I think coming from a place where you're encouraging, honest discussion and engagement, if you can do that without it getting either of you getting angry, I think is obviously a beautiful thing. That's obviously the hard part, though. People have tempers, and these are very hot button issues. So it can be challenging.
Thank you, Daniel. Oh, all right. Let's go to thank you, Daniel. Let's go to Guy in Hantsville, Alabama. I'm familiar with Hantsville, Alabama. There's some cool stuff there. Listening on the EWTN app. Guy, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. I was just wondering, because I know, like, the real definition of, like, feminism doesn't really, like, I don't know, it kind of contradicts what actual feminists, like, say and believe. Mm-hmm. And I was just, like, wondering how to, like, present this to them in, like, the most charitable way to just, like, have a conversation with the feminists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
No, I think that's a great question. I think this is one of the things is just that, first of all, recognizing just the unhappiness. It's, you don't have to dig too far before you find women who are experiencing incredible amounts of anxiety, depression, and whatnot. Starting from that place in terms of, like, if feminism is so great, why are we so unhappy? And, it's usually sort of the similar answer you get from communism. Well, it hasn't actually ever been tried. Anyway, so I think that's a piece. But I think really, the bigger thing, and this is what I was saying to the last caller, was just this idea of one of the things that feminism has inculcated is this combative nature in women. Sometimes you just want to have a conversation, and it doesn't stay that way. It ends up becoming very embattled. And this is very intentionally. And I talk about this, this idea of women feel like we get triggered so easily. Like we have to defend ourselves all the time. And I think that's what really makes it so challenging to have these kinds of conversations. And then, of course, shutting down men because you're men and, all of that. So I think it's, it's almost feels like you have to sort of tackle it from the flank somehow. And you have to feel like, And maybe that's where the objective, like finding good content that you can share. My friend Hannah Speer is a Jewish psychiatrist in Switzerland, and she's done all this amazing work on, you know, what's happened with women, and that there are three parts of women's lives, three different points, when what women physiologically generally want and what the culture tells us we should do that don't match up. And that's what's creating so much anxiety and depression in women, is that, you know, and it happens around the early childbearing years. It happens when, you know, later on when children are leaving home, and then it happens, you know, later on retirement stages. So there's all these different elements that I think are, you know, mixed messaging that we're giving to women. So finding something objective that's not necessarily coming from you, feels like kind of the best way to sort of tackle it, so that you can kind of dial down some of the intensity of it. I think that's what's seems really important. And even just, you know, expressing that, saying, I know this is a hard topic and something really, you know, that's challenging, because we've heard like one voice on this for forever, but it feels like we need to, you know, it's important to have a conversation, because women aren't happy, because mental illness is off the charts, because we're in a birth dearth, because, you know, loneliness is an incredible problem, you know, and just even pressing into that idea of what are the incredible gifts that women have, and how do those differ from men? You know, starting in someplace very simple, I think would be probably a great place to go, instead of, you know, those places that really trigger people.
Okay, Guy?
Yeah, that helps.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I wonder if you what you would think of men, especially young men, reading this book, because here's my concern, that there is a kind of reaction to feminism going on right now, which seems to me to involve some unhealthy aspects, because usually when we're reacting, you know, we don't moderate well. So almost all reacting involves overreacting, at least some level of overreacting. Mm-hmm. And so we're getting a kind of hyper masculinity, but a hyper performance of masculinity, you know, an almost strutting kind of masculinity that I'm not going to allow myself to be put down by these women who are, because men, I think men know that there's an implicit attack on their role in a lot of the you go girl kind of feminism. It's very anti-male, and they figure it out from the time they're boys. Yeah. So I guess what I'm asking you is, could men reading your book have a healthier response? I'm trying to, how can we prompt a healthier, more humane response, and not the performance of hypermasculinity?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question, and something that I was very conscious of when writing the book. And I actually have a whole section on it where I talk about, you know, I think one of the things that actually is a kind of amazing to me is the fact that it took this long to elicit this kind of reaction in men. Like,
men,
why didn't this happen sooner? You know,
I know.
I think it speaks to the fact that men really do love women, and they really do want to help women and give women what they think they need. And so if you look at this generation of young men, whom I have a lot of deep respect for, most, you know, a fair number of them have actually never met a very maternal, caring, nurturing kind of woman. Like, there just aren't that many. So they don't have the experience of that, that value that has been added to their life, and on all these different levels. There's always this combativeness. So really what they're doing is absolutely they're reacting, but the what they're reacting to is the contempt that women have poured out onto them. And they're just mirroring. They're saying, you're going to have contempt for me. I'm going to have contempt for you. And I'm going to debase you and use you in the way that men do, because they see women doing something similar in the way that women do. So I think that's obviously a huge problem, because then you're never going to bring healing and reconciliation and order.
Yes.
And, you know, the complementarity can never come out in that. It comes out in disorder complementarity, because men and women hurt each other differently. So I think that's something just obviously we have to be acutely aware of, just that brokenness and the response that it's elicited. And that's obviously not what Christ calls us to. He calls us to something so much deeper and more beautiful and compelling. And you know, this is one of the things that I think is vitally important for understanding you know, the roles of men and women is really understanding, first of all, what motherhood is. Every woman is called to motherhood, not just biological motherhood, or not only biological motherhood, but we're called to spiritual motherhood. We're called to bring life to others. Yes. And we have this incredible set of gifts that we can do that naturally. You know, this is why even our spiritual mothers, you know, the abbess is called mother superior. There's something very importantly maternal about that. And we see that obviously in, you know, mirrored in the church, Holy Mother Church, or the Bride of Christ, that like, these are not social constructs. These are things that are very deeply instilled in us from creation that God has instituted in the church to help us navigate these things and see the importance and beauty of them. At the same time, you also have this very important element of fatherhood of men and restoring to men their gifts of protection, providing, and procreating, and giving those back. And I've actually had, you know, I did a conference recently, a women's conference, and I talked about some of these ideas. And one of the women came up to me afterwards and said, "I am going to go home and apologize to my husband because I've been taking everything that he's supposed to do, and I'm trying to do it all myself. And I'm the head. I take care of everything. The way she's describing it, he's just like one of her children. He has no responsibility, has no headship, he has nothing. She's doing both jobs, you know. And so you can see very quickly how exhausting that is for her, but also, you know, deep sympathy for him because he's never been actualized as a man. You know, he's never been brought into his manhood. So I think the problems are very, very related. Once you start really, you know, diving into the beauty and the goodness of both, then the complementarity can come back into sort of a 3D realm.
Dr. Carrie Gress, our guest, we're talking about feminism and Christianity, and you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. I have to take the last break. We'll come back. Grace in Florida, we'll get to you first, and then as many calls as we can, we'll get to with Dr. Carrie Gress right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now, our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
This month, EWTN Radio prepares you for Lent with Father Benedict Rochelle's daily Lenten meditations, Lenten reflections from priests across England, and of course, Catholic Radio's premier shows featuring Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers, Dr. David Anders, Father Mitch Pacwa, the world over with Raymond Arroyo, and more. EWTN Radio, your source of truth that allows Catholics to grow in their faith and recognize the true mission of the Catholic Church.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I said I'm going back to Grace in Florida when we come back, but I think can I go to Grace now? Are we still talking to Grace? Let's see. Let's find out. Grace in Florida, listening on Divine Mercy Radio. You are on with Dr. Carrie Gress. Do we have you, Grace?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Carrie Gress. I got my Grace and Gress messed up there. I apologize. I got all confused for a sec.
You know, I don't really have a question. I'm just really going to make a comment. Number one, I think that you have to define feminism. I don't think that people understand, you know, where you're coming from with that. And I think that, you know, women don't understand, and basically society doesn't understand, that women and men are very different. We have estrogen in our brain, and men have more testosterone, and it's just a different way of being. Mm-hmm. And so I think that society somehow has confused with being equal to being more masculine, where we have to embrace our feminine side, you know, our feminine spirituality, which is very beautiful. And I don't think women really understand that because we're not taught that.
And so Grace, I'm going to let her I'm going to let you continue, Grace, but I want Carrie to address this because it's a fascinating point. I don't want to move off it too quickly, but I'm not letting you go. I'm just letting Carrie respond real quick.
No, I think that's a great point. This is one of the things that I discovered early on in the 1800s was this idea that women were told they were going to be a lot happier if they acted like men. And this is kind of a continuous idea. And this is where we get to this point where women feel like they're at war with their fertility. They feel like they're at war with their own bodies. And, you know, feminism has, in the name of this idea of being happy like men, we've taken away the home. We've taken away husbands. We've taken away children. We've taken away our fertility. And now we're actually even taking away healthy tissue in women's bodies because we've so confused this idea of the masculine with the feminine. So I think that's sort of the quick walk through what we've seen in the last century. So I think you're exactly right. We haven't really done any kind of job in understanding what the feminine is. And that's, of course, the beauty that the church offers us is we're not stuck using just the models that are around us in the world right now, but we have the saints. We have Our Lady. We have, incredible women, everyone from St. Catherine of Siena and St. Teresa of Avila. We've got Joan of Arc. You know, you can see the way that embodied feminism, I'm sorry, that embodied feminine has, played itself out in these unique individuals throughout history and these different saints. So I think that is an important piece, is getting back to kind of understanding, well, what does it mean to be feminine? And I think that the core piece is, again, this idea of motherhood. And this is why we can't define what a woman is broadly in the culture, because everybody's been told that our fertility isn't important or it's sort of secondary. And without understanding that the real value and importance of the maternal and the role that plays, especially in mature women and, you know, those various seasons of life. It's not like there's just one part where you're going to be maternal, but it should, you know, cover the whole crest of a woman's life and used in manifold ways, whether it's in work or at home or, combination of both.
Grace, go ahead.
Something. I think that movements, arise for a reason. And even though this movement arose and is misguided, and in my opinion, it's very evil, it did arise because of the patriarchy and because of men did abuse, the abuse of women, and the fact that, they were the breadwinners and they controlled and manipulated the household. And so I think because of the abuse in the household and not really honoring the feminine, I think that's why this arose. And even though it's misguided, I think that we can turn it around if we start teaching what feminine spirituality is and how estrogen acts in the brain. It's a bonding hormone. And so when men and women casually sleep together, the men, they sleep with a woman and, they can be friends, but because of estrogen is a bonding hormone, the woman gets emotionally attached immediately. And so because we don't understand the difference, women think that they can be like men and we're not. We're not like men.
And okay, Grace,
we will never
let's
be
get
like men, and we won't want to be. We're women.
Carrie, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I mean, this is one of the fascinating pieces is that, looking back at all the women in history that were promoting feminism, absolutely, there was this very well-intended effort to try and help women not be abused. And obviously, so valiant and important. But the tragedy is did it work? Have we protected women from battery, sexual exploitation, physical abuse, all the things that were problematic before? And the answer is no. And this is, the point that I made earlier about we've had this new kind of slavery of degradation and use. And that's because feminism was the wrong solution for a problem. And the problem, I think it was trying to say that patriarchy was the problem. And I think if we have and I go through this a lot in the book, if we have a real authentic understanding of patriarchy and hierarchy, who's at the top of that? It's Christ himself. And then the Pope and then the bishops and then clergy. clergy, et cetera. There's something very beautiful and compelling about patriarchy. We have to understand, and even the role of husbands, you know, leading the household, and the incredible gifts that men bring to that. And that, again, is discussed in the book. So I think there has to be some shifting and sort of ordering and understanding historically what actually happened, what actually worked, and how effective this has been in terms of helping men and women understand themselves better. And I think, you know, we've gotten to this point where we can definitively say feminism has not provided the cure to women that it has promised. It's only made things much, much worse because of the fact that it creates this confusion. So I certainly agree with you about the confusion between the male and the female, but I think we're also living in a place where we don't even see the value and importance of patriarchy because it's so denigrated and not talked about. But there's incredible values to it. And I think that's something that we also need to spend more time just to even appreciating the gifts that men have and they bring to certainly the family and relationships and just even ordered society.
Grace, I'm going to... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Grace. I apologize. I didn't... Go ahead.
Christ is different. If the patriarchy is sick... then what are women going to do?
Okay.
That's Carrie. The problem is that the patriarchy, the first place where we see the devaluing of patriarchy is in Mary Wollstonecraft back in 1792. And she's a radical thinker. She thinks that anything in the church is bad. She's trying to get rid of Catholicism entirely. And she also thinks the military is bad. She wants egalitarianism. She wants everybody to be exactly the same. And so this is the problem is that that's the idea that has been taken. And so if you even ask somebody, what is the patriarchy there, especially women, most of us can't really even define what it is or even understand what it is and the role that it plays. And, you know, we do understand it when it comes to corporate America. And it's fascinating to see, you know, the women that decry patriarchy in one sense, then have a problem with any kind of male or have problems with male hierarchy, then don't have a problem with it either in the military or corporate America. So I think in a lot of ways it's become this boogeyman. Absolutely. Have there been men who have abused women and maltreated them? Absolutely. But we know that the answer is not to denigrate or get rid of the patriarchy. We know what it is to go deeper into Christ, into his church, into deep, deep conversion, and make men more like Christ instead of, again, collapsing everything into this genderless egalitarianism, which has been the goal for a long time.
Grace, I'm very grateful for the call and thank you very much for the very enlightening conversation. Carrie, I wonder how young women respond. Do young women read your work and go, the scales have fallen from my eyes, I see it all now, or do they go, you are a horrible person and you don't get it? Which reaction do you get?
I get all of the above. But the thing that is most fascinating to me is that young women are so open to this. That there's no attachment to feminism the way that there are for boomer women and Gen X women. And of course, there are exceptions and plenty who have, you know, reached out to me and told me how my books have actually changed their life or changed their marriage, changed their relationship at home or with their children. I mean, it's really very humbling to hear. You know, how something that you put out there can actually, dramatically change people's perspective. But young women, because of the fact that they don't have this baggage like my generation above do, there's a real ease there, I think, to thinking about it differently. And I'm very hopeful about it because it seems like there's a real change coming that they recognize there's problems and they're open to changing them.
Boy, it really did have to go on for a long time, though, for people to finally go, this doesn't work. This isn't what I want from my life.
Right. Yeah. No, and that's I think one of the fascinating things is you can kind of see the arguments that were made around the 1890s, early 1900s about, you know, against monogamy and, you know, all these idealizations of what would happen, that, you know, children be wanted and all the same things that we've heard Paul VI say in Humanae Vitae. But not that they didn't have the actual experience of what happens when you completely eliminate cultural mores, and especially with relation to sexuality. Right. So you can kind of give them some leeway and just say they didn't see this really firsthand the way that we have now that we're in the third or fourth generation of it. Yeah. So I think that's, you know, one of the reasons why we have all this hard data. It's time to start looking at it and using it and acting on it instead of, you know, pretending it doesn't exist.
Dr. Carrie Gress has been our guest. I was delighted to start the hour with her agreeing with me that she is our friend here at Catholic Answers. That's a good way to start an hour. Check out her newest book, Something Wicked: Why Feminism Can't Be Fused with Christianity. Get some arguments and some insights that maybe you are not getting anywhere else. They may be very, very helpful in, for all of us, men and women, having those scales fall from our eyes. So that we can turn to the Lord for some healing. And that's what's needed. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.